Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GOC-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. In this episode, we're going to be talking about something a little bit different to our norm. Rather than looking at the eye itself, we're exploring the periorbital area, and in particular, the eyelids and the skin close to the eye, and any dermatological issues that you might pick up while doing an eye examination. Skin conditions are really common in this country. For example, up to 30% of children and 10% of adults in the UK suffer from eczema. Although it might not be obvious from the outset, it's important that optometrists like you and me understand the skin conditions that could be of concern to our patients. They could simply be an annoyance, or they could be the sign of a more serious underlying health condition. As optometrists, we may be in a great position to help patients early on when their eye area is affected by a skin condition, because sometimes it can be difficult to access a GP or a dermatologist in a timely fashion, and this is where you could come to the rescue. And our listeners clearly agree. I've had several requests from colleagues to clarify how we can best manage our patients when they have allergic or inflammatory skin conditions like eczema or other dermatoses. And we want to also know the impact that topical treatments might have. So this month, I have put these questions to Brian Murphy, a consultant dermatologist at Cathedral Health in Belfast. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you, Michelle?
I'm very well, thank you. So, Brian, I know that you have recently presented on this topic to optometrists at a CPD event in Belfast. So why do you think it's important for optometrists to have a better understanding of dermatology in general?
Well, I think it's not an unknown fact that across the board there are delays and shortages in patients being able to seek a dermatologist for various queries, whether it be a lump, a bump or a rash. And people are getting their eyes checked all the time and more readily maybe able to see their optometrist than even being able to access their GP. So you're probably seeing some people before they even met anyone medical and recognizing or picking up issues on the eyes, even sometimes patients that might not even know that they have a problem. Because obviously the skin covering the eye is such a sensitive area. It's probably some of the most delicate, thinnest skin on the lids that we have over the body. So certainly rashes will appear there very readily, and they can be irritated and provoked by things that you're using not only in the eyes but around the face. So you could be the first port of call as an optometrist in seeing these problems and being able to flag it up to a patient, and maybe, or hopefully, after listening to this discussion, being able to chat to them a little bit about it.
And what conditions tend to affect the eye and the sort of the periocular region?
So I suppose I always talk about dividing skin and dermatology into two sides of things. You've got your lumps and your bumps, and obviously skin cancers, and then you've got rashes. So I suppose a broad thing in terms of lumps or bumps, they can be benign or they can be something cancerous that obviously needs to be taken more seriously. But certainly, even when things are benign, they can be a nuisance for patients. So knowing some of the benign marks that you can reassure someone about, or maybe what they could maybe do about it if it's causing a nuisance, and then obviously knowing which ones you should worry about and ensure they've been seen by a dermatologist or their GP. And then in terms of rashes, there's an exponential amount of things that can potentially affect around the eyes. But what I would sort of divide them up into are your allergic type rashes. So your contact dermatitis, where something exogenous, like a cream, eyedrop or a spray has annoyed the skin. You've got your inflammatory problems, which can arise secondary to connective tissue problems like dermatomyositis, and then issues like perioral dermatitis, where you're having issues with papules and pustules and spots and dots arising around the eyes, possibly even aggravated by some of the treatments you might think you'd give for skin problems, like steroids, or people using, in this day and age, too heavy or thick a range of skincare products. Other inflammatory issues might include rosacea, which you'll all know about, can affect specifically around the eyes, but tends to be a more general rash that affects the face and skin and otherwise.
And you have mentioned a few conditions that do have ocular problems associated with them as well. So which are the ones that tend to sort of flag in terms of if you've got that particular dermatological condition, you'll also likely to have ocular problems as well.
The big one would be rosacea, because it causes such inflammation of the lids and then indeed secondarily then the cornea. Patients getting dry eye, irritation, keratitis, either on its own or as a secondary problem to their inflamed and swollen lids. Patients with eczema, for example, can have an atopic conjunctivitis as well as their atopic dermatitis on the skin. So they kind of go hand in hand. And we have great treatments for people with widespread eczema, such as dupilumab. But you'll probably all have seen patients coming in describing a dry or irritable eye on dupilumab because it's a known side effect of the treatment. So having an awareness of that, because medicine and drugs and therapeutics is changing all the time.
Yeah, it's a constantly changing environment, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
You really do have to keep on top of it.
100%.
Just to focus on periocular conditions, the sort of the rashes from that point of view, if a patient were to walk in through the door and have an eye examination, can you just run through how you think we should approach evaluating a periocular skin condition in that eye examination setting?
So when you're looking at the skin, obviously looking at the patient as a whole, so is there anything else going on? You know, you'll pretty much pick up straight away if someone has a full-on red face or very dry and scaly skin. Is it just the face? Is it on their hands? Because they may be able to quickly tell you, yes, I have eczema or I have psoriasis. And that will possibly answer the problem you're looking at. But if it's very focused just around the eye, is it one eye? Is it both? Because sometimes, even though you'd expect if something's a contact or allergic dermatitis to be both eyes, because more often makeups, false eyelashes, even your specs will affect both. It might be that the patient has been rubbing one of their eyes with their finger because they've had maybe had something in the eye, and that in itself has been transferring particulates from their gel nails or something else onto the face. So that's useful to know. But as I say, it's not just stuff you're putting on your skin that can cause the allergies. It can be spritzed in the air. So it could be your diffuser and the plug in your bedroom, or it could be something that you may be exposed to at work. And then an important thing from your point of view would be, is it having an impact on the vision? Because that's going to be something you're going to be taking quite seriously, because you want to make sure that they're not going to be losing vision because of a skin problem. And similarly, knowing the things to be really worried about. So I suppose your red flags are your funny looking lesions, your bleeding lesions, your lumps that are ulcers that have grown pretty quickly, or something that you think cancer, encourage them to rapidly see their GP. But equally so, patients who appear with very puffy, swollen eyes, if you think that's angioedema and you think they're allergic to something that's not just a cream or whatever, or that they're unwell, wheezy, describing tight throat or their voice is altered, well, that's obviously a medical emergency. We're thinking almost about anaphylaxis, and those sorts of patients, you'd be telling them to go to A&E to get looked at.
So you mentioned a couple of quite unusual things that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of as triggering an allergic reaction, such as particles off the gel nails and the diffuser in the bedroom. So I take it those are the kind of things that you've come across.
Oh, I see lots and lots of things. And really, the more and more I learn about contact dermatitis and the allergens and sit in on lectures on it, you realise that, my goodness, there's very little you can avoid. Patients will attend me and say, I've stopped using my artificial eyelashes, I've stopped using that eye drop that may be itchy, and it's still happening. And the history that I would take for and I wouldn't expect an optometrist to do that, but certainly when they see me for consideration of what we call patch testing, where we put little strips of chemicals in the back and assess at day 3 and day 5 as to whether there's a rash appearing within any of the ingredients that are on that patch test list. That gives me the information I need to be able to tell the patient, right, you're allergic to this chemical or this ingredient. But there's so many types or bundles of these chemicals that can be done. You couldn't put them all on one person's back. So the history taking and trying to pick up, were they allergic to it? And fascinating thing is that the acrylic nails, not only are they a problem, acrylates, which are obviously the ingredient that patients can be allergic to, there's loads of them. They can also be found in a certain branded wristwatch that measures your heart rate and people would use when they're at the gym. And they're also now found in the boxes that patients would have if they maybe, for example, have a diabetes and it's monitoring their BAMs. Those can also have acrylates in them. So there's so many sources from where patients become allergic. And one I'd even learned about recently was people who wash their partner's clothing. If the partner is bringing home dust on their clothes and shaking it in the utility room before it goes in the washing machine. So it would blow your mind when you're trying to pick these things. And sometimes you get ingredients on someone who's maybe a housewife and you're thinking, well, hold on, why are you allergic to cement dust? You can see where these things come up.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned a history of symptoms there. What do you think we should be asking patients, you know, if they do come in with a rash that looks like contact type dermatitis?
Well, I suppose from a simple point of view, you're probably not going to have the time or know-how in terms of getting into a specific allergen or ingredient questionnaire like mine. But I suppose a basic thing to do would be, how long have you had this for? Has there been anything over the last few months you've changed, whether it's in skincare, even cleaning products in the house, new fragrances, perfumes, the obvious sorts of things, and sort of encourage them to say, well, actually, maybe keep a bit of a diary. Is there something that you think could be provoking this? And could you avoid it for a few weeks to see if that makes a difference? And I suppose general advice would be, particularly if you're not a prescriber, you're not too sure, encourage them to go and see their doctor or book in with a dermatologist, but just keep their skincare and their moisturiser really plain and simple until they know what they can and can't use.
So we've kind of talked around sort of the allergic contact dermatitis. What are the other types of dermatitis that we might come across?
So we talked briefly earlier on about atopic dermatitis. So that's where you have a genetic predisposition to an altered skin barrier, and that induces the inflammation, your redness, your itch, and a vicious cycle then of scratching that people do. So those sorts of patients can be more likely to develop contact dermatitis, but patients with atopic dermatitis may or may not suffer itch, red, dry eyes as part of their overall presentation. And they'll obviously most likely have involvement of their eczema at other body sites, behind the knees, the elbow, inner elbows and so forth, would be quite common things that patients would mention with their atopic dermatitis. Earlier on, I had mentioned periocular dermatitis. So that's not strictly anything to do with an eczema, but it's an inflammatory disorder whereby patients would present with pustules or papules, which we call red dots under the size of 5 millimeters, for example, around the eyes, but it can also affect around the mouth and the nostrils. So it's actually truly called periorofiscal dermatitis rather than specifically perioral dermatitis. And that can be very easily provoked by use of topical steroids in those at risk. So I quite often meet patients who've been slapping on the hydrocortisone to try and get rid of this, because that's how you would treat an eczema otherwise. But we know that perioral dermatitis can flare with steroid. And a lot of people are using very complex skincare regimes now, tretinoins, thick moisturizers, everything that it says on TikTok they should be doing to keep their skin right. But actually some of these products can completely degrade and alter their skin barrier to where they might start to develop things like perioral dermatitis, or indeed become sensitive or allergic to them with the contact dermatitis that we talked about.
So in practice, quite often we do see patients coming in with rashes related to eczema, for example. Is it ever appropriate for an IP optometrist to be prescribing for these skin conditions? You know, for example, they might want to prescribe hydrocortisone.
The likes of hydrocortisone are sometimes a little bit stronger. So long as it's used safely in short bursts, my standard for sort of eczemas around the eyes, if they're very active, would be a 3 to 5 day course of something like hydrocortisone. And then stepping that down to a non-steroid anti-inflammatory such as Protopic or topical tacrolimus. But if you are able to do so and you feel something is an eczema, then a short burst of hydrocortisone will not only give that patient some relief, but also give them something to tide them over until they see their doctor in case they need something stronger or something that can't be prescribed. I suppose the word of warning would be that if you suspect or you're worried that this patient has a cold sore virus or an infection, then you shouldn't be prescribing topical steroid. As you all will know, the Hutchinson sign of herpes virus in the tip of the nose and involvement of the eyes, if you think it's papular, golden, crusty or infected, no steroid.
You mentioned Protopic. How does that work?
So Protopic or tacrolimus, and it's for another drug called pimecrolimus, they're non-steroid anti-inflammatories. So they're a fantastic tool in the box that we use in dermatology for as a part of our step-down regimes. The subtype of molecules are called calcineurin inhibitors, and they help in effect to mimic the anti-inflammatory effect of a steroid, but without all of the side effects.
So you mentioned side effects there. Optometrists are aware of the risk of cataract with long-term steroid use, but thinking about the skin, the side effects of thinning or even having a withdrawal reaction could be more problematic, couldn't it? Because the skin is already thinner and more delicate in that periorbital area.
Yeah, so if I'm prescribing for an eczema or a psoriasis patient, I'll usually start with a stronger steroid to get things under control and then sort of come down the ladder through a potent to moderately potent, mildly potent, and then a non-steroid. Because a lot of patients, particularly with chronic skin issues like atopic eczema, they'll always have a potential that their problem will rebound at some point. So having a non-steroidal like tacrolimus to maintain and prevent those flares in between, maybe using it once or twice a week, even if the skin is settled, that stretches out those relapse periods and elongates the remission period for them to move on and live their life.
But are there any risks with drugs like Protopic?
Compared to steroids, no. They're a lot safer to use in the long term. And as I say, the one thing I wouldn't encourage is that people are fearful of use of steroids. If you need to use it, you have to use it. But it's where you're getting to a point where you can't stop the steroids. You find you're getting no remission or Protopic isn't working. That's when you do need to come and see someone like us. Because at that point, usually the GPs maybe will be unable to help further. And we're able maybe to fully assess and say, well, have we got the right diagnosis? Protopic, the main things I talk about are obviously your infection risks again, because it's mimicking a steroid. It definitely stings. A lot of patients would find when they use Protopic, it stings. That's where I don't like to use it for acute flares. That's where your steroid kicks in. Because if you've got sort of raw inflamed skin and then you put Protopic on it, which would normally sting, it's sort of rubbing salt into a wound, which no one likes. And then they're not going to use it further down the line when it would suit. And it can also make patients more sensitive to sunlight. So it's if you're using it, my advice is normally if it's a very sunny day and you're going to be out and about, if you're not able to wear sunglasses and sit in the shade, it would be to leave it and just put it on at night time so that you're not encouraging the skin to burn or go red.
So you mentioned earlier that with hydrocortisone, you might suggest a, say, 3 to 5 day course. Mm-hmm. With Protopic, if you're putting someone on Protopic, would you use that twice a day for a few days as well? Or is that just once or twice a week?
Yeah, for me, the step down would be, you know, hydrocortisone or appropriately stronger depending on the site, down to Protopic twice a day, maybe for a week, and then a maintenance dose of once or twice per week.
And hopefully that would keep things under control. But as you say, even if you can give the patient some relief while they're waiting to see their GP or a dermatologist, because patients don't have the same ready access to a dermatologist as they might do to their community optometrist.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else that we can recommend to patients in terms of helping with their skin condition on their face or around their eyes? Perhaps they don't need a steroid or, you know, something like Protopic. Quite often, emollients are quite a good go-to as well, aren't they? Is there any particular type of emollient that you find is more effective or better for the delicate eye area, periorbital area?
Well, the emollients and the steroid, they want to complement each other. So you're not using one or the other. Mm. Your emollient is there as a nourishing agent to soothe the altered barrier, let's call it. And then your steroid or Protopics are there as an anti-inflammatory. So you're still going to be using moisturizers. In fact, we encourage people to use those when they're treating any rashes. But everyone should continue to use their moisturizers even after the flare has settled, because they've obviously got an issue with around their eyes. My motto would be the blander the better, particularly when you've got an active problem, because we all know you can spend a fortune on stuff that have got a nice label on them and have full of active ingredients. That for some people, that's fine. But as we said, the skin around the eyes is a lot more sensitive. It's more likely to provoke an irritancy. So there's various oatmeal branded products out there that are nice, simple moisturizers that aren't going to cause too much harm. And they've got non-foaming cleansing agents within them as part of their range. So the simpler, the better. But a tip I give anyone, particularly if they're worried about developing a sensitivity or a rash with something, or they're very sensitive skin, is to apply some of that moisturiser agent on the inner elbow 3 to 4 times a day, or even more so for up to a week to 10 days. If you're not getting a rash on the inner elbow with that test patch, then you hopefully be able to test it on your face. But if you're getting a rash there, then that skin's almost as sensitive as the lid, so you're not going to put it on your face. So it's a little trick that people can do if they're not too sure whether they should invest in the big bottle or whatever.
So Brian, we've focused so far very much on eczema because we do see quite a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But what are the other types of skin conditions? What are the key features that we need to look out for that might help us differentiate one condition from another? For example, inflammatory versus allergic versus seborrheic.
Okay, so well, you mentioned seborrheic dermatitis there, which we haven't talked about, and it is a condition that is akin to, well, dandruff, as people would commonly call it, and it's caused by a yeast in our skin called Malassezia, and that commonly presents with a kind of a waxy redness with scale, and patients with periocular seborrheic dermatitis might get scaling within their eyebrows. They might have a sort of scaly, uncomfortable rash around their nostrils, possibly in the scalp, not everyone, their chest and back. It can sometimes overlap with psoriasis, so that can be another rash that can affect the face. And those patients who have that same distribution of maybe scaling and thickened rash in the scalp or eyebrows, they might also complain of plaques on their elbows or a family history of a rash like psoriasis. And that might be a telltale sign that that's what they have. your other conditions in terms of inflammatory. We've talked earlier on about perioral dermatitis and what that looks like. And one very important rash that affects around the eyes and can probably be quite easily misinterpreted as eczema is dermatomyositis. That is an inflammatory autoimmune disorder that can have numerous other parts of the body involved, for example, the lungs, sometimes Raynaud's syndrome with tight fingers and problems with the joints, and it can even be associated in rare circumstances with underlying malignancies. So dermatomyositis might present to an optometry clinic with a flat, subtly purple rash around the eyes, which we call a heliotrope rash. And if you're seeing a patient like that and you think it's eczema, they're normally talking about itch, they've been scratching at it, it maybe have broken skin, whereas this just appears on its own. Some people, that's all that they have. Others might have signs on their hands where they get purpley and thickened plaques over the knuckles called Gottring's papules. And they may also describe weakness of the shoulder muscles or the hips, so they find it difficult to get out of the chair, or combing their hair tires them very easily. So with those sorts of signs, you're thinking, right, this is someone who really needs to see their doctor sooner rather than later.
So you've mentioned lumps, bumps and rashes, and I've kind of skipped over the first bit and gone to rashes. But if we backtrack a little bit now and think about the lumps and the bumps, you mentioned lesions. What are the key things to look out for to help us identify what type of lesion a person, you know, might have?
It's like an open the encyclopedia now, and let's start from the beginning because there's so many. But I, as I said to you earlier on, I suppose you've got your benign lumps and bumps, and then you've got your cancer. So if we focus in on benign, the sorts of things that I see around the eyes are the brown crusty marks that people nickname as age warts, but they're actually nothing to do with being viral or contagious. They're called seborrheic keratosis. And these develop in people who have a genetic predisposition to them. So they tend to run families. They're very similar to skin tags around the neck or folds. And again, all the sorts of things that we get as we get older. But when they do grow in areas like around the eye or close to the nose, people often describe it blocking their vision or having an impact on their vision. So they want it treated. So brown, crusty, they almost have a stuck-on raisin look about them is how we would describe them. Then benign cysts. So obviously, as optometrists, you'll know very well, you know, meibomian cysts, your styes and block glands around the lids and how they can become inflamed, sometimes infected. And similarly, cysts might appear outside of the mucosal surface on the skin and be an epidermal or a benign cyst. So an oval lump that's growing and mobile under the skin, possibly a cyst. Moving then towards the more concerning ones, if something's starting to have an impact on the surface of the skin, if it's starting to break the skin down, become an ulcerated, bleed, pain, or something that rapidly evolves and doesn't look like they're normal. For example, the seborrheic keratosis, most patients will maybe have others on their back or somewhere like that. Equally, if it looks new or different to their normal, they should always get it checked. But with the concerning lumps or bumps, it's the ugly duck, as we call it. It stands out completely different to their usual. Those are the sort of alarm signs we would tell patients to get checked early. Reassuringly, not everything that we see in a query cancer clinic is going to be a tumour, but if there's suspicion there, you should be encouraging people to take that straight back to the doctor to get onto the right pathway and get it looked at.
So I have my notes here to ask you about the problem that can occur with poorly fitting spectacles. Can you tell me about a scenario where you've actually come across that?
Yes. So the lesion that you're alluding to is acanthoma fissuratum, and it's a thickening of the skin due to poorly fitted nose pads on either side of the nasal bridge, and it can induce almost like a scar-like process. But it can look cosmetically unappealing for patients, but also their glasses might become impacted. They may not be able to sit as normally as they previously did. So I often tell patients where they have a condition like that to go back and get their glasses fitted, because it usually does soften down if things are fitted correctly. Some do still come ahead and have it be shaved down or removed surgically just to get rid of it. But that's one of the benign lesions we would see on the side of the nose.
So, Brian, just to finish off, as optometrists, we're obviously not experts in skin conditions. So there will be times when we do have to refer to a GP for onward referral to a dermatologist. From your point of view, what would you like to see on the referral that we sent?
Irrespective of the referral, it's good to know what you've picked up from a patient, just to give me an idea of why you were worried or what your thoughts were on it. Keep it succinct, but certainly don't be afraid to put it down, because what you've teased out of the patient might be something they'll forget and then not tell their doctor.
And again, when people do have non-specific symptoms, keeping a diary makes a big difference, doesn't it? Because it hones the information a little bit, so it's easier to spot patterns
absolutely
in behaviour or in allergens and so on.
Definitely. And a massive help for me with any patient I see is that they've got photographs, because things wax and wane, particularly with rashes. So if you see something, ask them for their phone, take a photograph of it, get them to email it to themselves, because I suppose more than anything else, because I can take the history, a photograph is so helpful, because they might go away and realise, oh gosh, yes, it was that new eyeshadow, I'm going to stop that, and then everything settles down. So I never actually see what the original problem was, but if there's good quality unblurred photos, it's really helpful to me. So that would probably be my top tip for making a referral back.
And you know, today we have actually covered quite a lot of ground that is unfamiliar to us, but if we do feel that we need to get some advice, are there any resources that you can recommend?
The website's through the British Association of Dermatologists, specifically their patient portal. It's called skinhealthinfo.org. It's a fantastic resource with leaflets, links to patient support groups and other resources. They also now have the British College of Dermatology, which people can register with. There are modules and things that you can complete on there. And then other websites like the Primary Care Dermatology Society website and DermNet, they've an A to Z encyclopedia of pictures and information pages for both optoms, anyone out there, and patients to have a look at.
And Brian, what would your top tips be for optometrists when managing a patient that presents with a periocular skin condition in the community practice? So I'm not thinking of the really serious ones, those ones we would be referring back to the GP or for onward management, but something that we might be able to think about managing, even if it's just with something quite simple. What are your top tips?
Take a deep breath, don't panic. Have a chat with the patient, let them talk to you. Sometimes they'll give you the answer. They've got another problem, and it's just about encouraging them to go back and get management, because a lot of people sometimes will forget or stop using their treatments. So sometimes that's a simple thing. If there's something that they can cut out that's been triggering it or avoiding it, and you've teased that out, and as long as it's safe to do so, not going to have any impact on their health otherwise, give them that gentle nudge to take a break from something. And I suppose you're the experts in the eye, you know, so if you can do nothing for the skin, but you think, well, actually, their eye's really sore because they've got gritty blepharitis secondary to their rosacea, or they've got itchy atopic conjunctivitis, and I don't know what to do with their skin, but I can help their eyes. Do what you can. Encourage them to do their warm compressions, do their lubricating drops and their eye drops and supplementary tears, because that's going to be something that we'll find helpful as a dermatologist when they do get to us, because that's not our area of expertise. So it's kind of a shared responsibility of the case.
So, Brian, that was great. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
And thank you for listening. If you head to dockets.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. Remember that if you go on to complete the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice. Make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss the next episode of Sound Optometry, out next month. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.